Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to EBC Radio. This is 1170 AM. It's time once again for Heartbeat. Heartbeat is an educational program about your health, which airs on EBC Radio every second and fourth Saturday of the month. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. I'm an interventional cardiologist. I'm the director of the catheterization laboratory at St. Peter's University Hospital and an attending at Robert Wood in New Brunswick and Princeton, with offices in Somerset, Monroe, East Brunswick. We've been bringing this show to you close to last 20 years and hope you enjoy and learn from this program. today, we're going to continue our series on discussion related to cancer care. But before I bring my guest on, I'd like to share with you a pretty big news story, which was in the medical circles, in the oncology world, and was all over the newspapers. There was a recent clinical trial in which 14 patients who had early stage rectal cancer, and they had that's about 5 to 10% of all the rectal cancers have a certain deficiency in the system, which causes a certain protein to be formed. And there was a drug which was used, and patients were given this drug intravenously about 9 times. And the amazing thing was that it basically made the cancer vanish. So it wasn't the traditional chemotherapy, the other stuff, radiation and surgery, which was done. And so it took the oncology world with a storm, and there is a lot of excitement. Obviously, time will tell how this pans out, but newer treatments are changing the entire spectrum for a lot of disorders, whether it's cancer, obviously, in heart disease, there has been a lot of progress, and a lot of genetic disorders in other parts of the body where a lot of work is being done. So this was all over the news, and it was exciting news for those patients who may have this particular form of rectal cancer. But as we all know, whenever someone has cancer, not every story is as good, whether in the forms of treatments which are available, in the extent of the illness which one has. And, whenever a diagnosis is made, it is extremely nerve-wracking at times, distressing for the individual as well as the family. And, one gets gets into the medical system to get the care one needs, in the hope that that there can be a long-term cure and a long-term solution. But as we all know, that unfortunately doesn't happen in every case. So in as much as the physicians are trying their best to try all forms of treatment, and in the show we've discussed with a variety of physicians in the past, whether it's chemotherapy or surgery or radiation, there's various forms. But there comes a time during the course of this entire illness when you need more than medicine. You just can't do the traditional modalities, because the biggest toll, which just the word cancer and the diagnosis and then all the tribulations around treatment which one has to go through, is the emotional piece of it. And if there was an adequate amount of emotional support, and in some cases dealing with pain as the cancer spreads, and then if it becomes in a late stage, helping the individual go through whatever is left in a form where there is support for the individual and the family, that becomes really big. Within the domain of medically treating, there are folks who specialize in that latter piece, which sometimes we don't pay as much attention to. And it's not only in cancer care, even in cardiac care. For example, I deal with patients who have advanced heart disease, and, you know, we reach a point where we're not able to do as much as we would want to. We turn to people who can provide a whole different element of care, which we as physicians sometimes are not focused on when we are dealing with just medicines and procedures and things like that. So to help us get a better sense of what is out there, familiarize us with the terminology and what it takes, I have on the phone with me Tina Bassanese. She's an advanced nurse practitioner. She has a certification in hospice and palliative care, and she is the director of palliative medicine and supportive care with Astera Cancer Care, which is a group in Central Jersey. So I appreciate her joining us to go over all this with us. So let me just make sure I have her on the air. Tina, are you on the phone, on the line?
I'm here. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you so much for taking the time. And, you know, in all these 20 years, I can't remember me having focused on this particular subject. So I appreciate it. And, you know, the reality is that more and more, as folks are living longer, these both supportive and end-of-life issues become so important, and I think you play an important role. So let me first just start by asking, you know, sometimes for some people, dealing with patients who are really sick can be hard. So how did you get interested in this aspect of medicine?
Thank you, Dinesh. I'm so thrilled to be with, you know, you and the folks, you know, in the area today to talk about this specialty, because I feel like there's so much misunderstanding about the benefit of it. So thank you so much for, you know, bringing me on today, and also for your beautiful intro, because I think it really helps set the platform for our conversation today. So my background is as an intensive care unit nurse. And I would say probably in the late 1990s, palliative care was very directly associated only with hospice and considered the care you get when you go on to hospice. And working in the ICU, I saw a lot of pain and suffering, a lot of, I want to say, lack of communication about goals of care, about realistically what was possible. And in that environment, there was obviously an attention on all the minute details that had to do with life-saving. So the broader picture wasn't often the focus. And everyone was, from the nurses to the doctors to the families, very much focused on, you know, different chemistry levels or oxygen levels, and not really seeing there was like this human being that they loved or that they were called to care for, you know, in that bed, and really the focus of our care. When you have people that are unconscious or sedated, it's often very difficult to get to know them. So we don't know who they are going in. What is their constitution? What are their goals and objectives? And in the late 90s, there wasn't as much of a focus on advanced care planning, which includes, you know, doing living wills and healthcare proxies and pulsed forms, which, you know, hopefully we'll get to talk about a bit today. And so for me as a participant in the care for these folks, I would feel very distressed. And as a nurse, I felt compelled to advocate for who was that person in the bed, right? And what was the real opportunity for them to kind of pull through that. And in the ICU, there's about a 10% mortality. So that means 90% of people will actually survive. So that's fabulous. But when you see that 10%, that 10% still matters. And so what drew me to palliative medicine as a specialty was wanting to be part of relieving the suffering associated with the experience of living with the critical illness, helping the families emotionally survive the experience of living with that serious illness, And then further, help my colleagues also prevent burnout by feeling like there was something we were doing to keep the patient at the center of what we were doing and not focusing on all of those different small, critical aspects of what we were managing moment to moment in the ICU. And so right around that time in the late 90s, palliative medicine was finding a space for itself outside of hospice and for those living with serious illness and not just those that were considered and, already predetermined to be in the terminal phase of life where there was no longer disease-directed treatment to manage their illness. You know, that group of patients had care. They had an opportunity and a recognized medical benefit through the hospice Medicare benefit, where those people that were still trying to get better didn't have, that cadre of services. And so the specialty of palliative medicine really was focused on being more upstream and focusing on the physical, emotional, spiritual suffering associated with a serious illness, and just not just those that were in the final phase of life or in that terminal phase of life. So I kind of found my way through my own professional burnout and sort of this drive for advocacy to find a nurse practitioner program at New York University that specialized in palliative care. And at the time, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, but it was such a gift. And I was on this, sort of like treadmill that was moving me along, going into Manhattan every day to get this education, to train at Mount Sinai, at NYU, at the, at the big medical centers that were trying to bring palliative care into the forefront of acute care. So I've had this long career of building programs on the acute care side. I was a hospice director for about 6 years, where I left sort of the clinical space and went truly administrative. And then it even further exemplified the differences in the incredible, wonderful benefit of hospice for those that were not using it early enough. And all my efforts as an administrator were trying to promote easier and earlier access to hospice services for those that were no longer getting disease-directed treatment. And at the same time, I built a community-based palliative care program for those people that were still very much interested and it was appropriate for them to get disease-directed treatment that were not in the terminal phase of life in that final, 6 months of life as determined by their doctor. And so this blend of doing acute care palliative medicine and going into the hospice space and then seeing the community as another opportunity really brought me to where I am now at Astera Cancer Care, where I'm doing palliative medicine and supportive care for our oncology patients that are living with serious illness. And many of them will live many years. And so sort of why I'm excited to talk to you all today is because I hope that when patients hear from their provider that they're being referred to palliative care, they don't get nervous, but instead they feel inspired that there's somebody that's going to listen to them from a whole person perspective and, get to know them as spiritual beings, as family members, as, how their pain and suffering affects them on all the levels, not just on their physical health, also ease the transition and support easier access for hospice care for those patients that are eligible, rather than seeing them go to a hospital and maybe die in an environment like an ICU that wouldn't necessarily be their wish had they had these conversations earlier and did some planning.
So,
but that's the long answer.
Right. Thank you. No, thank you for that. I think this is a great insight. So, folks, you're listening to EBC Radio. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. I'm talking to Tina Bassanese. She is an advanced nurse practitioner and director of palliative care at Astera. And we're talking about both palliative and other care for patients. The phone number in the studio, if at any time you have a question or a comment, is 732-297-9886, 732-297-9886. So, Tina, you know, you and I are familiar to a large extent with what all these terms mean, but there might be listeners who may not exactly be clear where palliative comes in, where hospice comes in. So let's just clarify for folks what these terms mean. And also, I'm also going to go through some of the definitions of some of the other terminology which came up with the advanced directive and things like that. So let's just get those out of the way. So help us understand what's the difference between palliative and hospice.
Great, thank you. Yeah, palliative care actually is a derivative of a Latin term, palliae, which is to cloak or to protect. So the word palliate in general means to relieve or promote comfort, right, to protect. So in essence, everything that we do in palliative care focuses on the relief of any kind of pain and suffering. And like I mentioned before, it's multidimensional, it's interdimensional. And so everything that patients receive in the hospice environment is to relieve suffering. Hospice is a medical benefit, is a philosophy of care for caring for patients that their disease, if it took its natural course, would live about 6 months or less. So it's a medical benefit, and it's a philosophy where patients and families can receive professional care, equipment, supplies, medications, 24-hour access to a nurse, in the comfort of their own home, or in a facility when they're no longer receiving any kind of curative medical care, and everything they're receiving is to relieve that pain and suffering. So that's why there's often this miscommunication, right? They think palliative care, right, I said, is the relief of pain and suffering. It's the medical care that focuses on the relief of pain and suffering. But hospice care is the receipt of palliative care for patients that if their disease took its natural course, they will live 6 months or less. That's by estimate. There's no crystal ball. Some patients will live, you know, a day if they join the program late. Some people will live a year or two on hospice. So the difference is palliative care is a medical specialty that focuses on the relief of suffering. It doesn't need to be just imparted onto patients that are living with serious with terminal illness. It could be for anybody that has pain and suffering. So it could be people with cardiac disease, and an example of that might be somebody with cardiac disease that has shortness of breath all the time related to their cardiac disease, and that may lead to depression or anxiety because they're not as mobile as they used to be. That can be for patients with a neurologic condition like a stroke, where maybe they have swallow concerns that leads to malnutrition, which can also lead to anxiety and depression because they're not able to consume food and participate in the social aspect of life with their families. So there's suffering associated with all of that, right? So that we change as people when we're living with a serious illness. So palliative care is a standalone medical specialty that focuses on the relief of pain and suffering for anybody living with a serious illness. They don't need to be in the terminal phase of life. Hospice care is a composite of services provided through Medicare and other private insurances that provides palliative care, medications, supplies, equipment, personnel, home health aides, all to support this last phase of life for patients that are living with a terminal condition. Does that help explain it?
Yes, I think. Well, it does, and hopefully, if somebody doesn't fully understand, they can always feel free to call us. The phone number in the studio is 732-297-9886. Now, another angle to this is, if let's say I have a patient and I feel that they're suffering and they're anxious or there is some issue where someone can come and provide them with that supportive care over and above the medicines and all we are giving. When I call that quote unquote a consult, or I bring someone like yourself in, and I just, this is to clarify for everybody listening, doesn't mean, especially when it's just the palliative, or even for that matter hospice, that doesn't mean that what we are saying is that the end is near, or we're not saying that, that there is no hope. What we are saying is that this condition is causing you to suffer over and above, the medical issue, whether it's emotional, whether it's pain, and we're bringing someone else in who is kind of well-versed in handling those components, because the reality is it's the reason it's a special separate subspecialty or a separate specialty is because not all of us are either trained or may have all the wherewithal to be able to provide that kind of care. Is that kind of an accurate description?
Yeah, that's absolutely perfect. And so an example of what I do now, maybe that will be helpful to clarify. So patients right now may be living with stage 2, 3, or 4 cancer. And the oncologist is focused on mitigating that cancer, right? Relieving that cancer, killing that cancer. They're looking at the blood counts. They're looking at what regimen is proper for that cell type, for that type of cancer. And that's the focus of their visit when you come in there to see them, right? They want to make sure that you're safe to receive treatment, that they're giving you the right type of treatment. They are providing you insight and information about, what you can anticipate, how long the regimen will be. So your visit may be very, it may be 15 minutes with them. They're going over all of that information. They're going to talk to you a bit about side effects. Oh, I'm going to give you this medication. This medication can cause diarrhea. This one can cause, your skin to start to peel. It can cause some shortness of breath. It can cause some fluid retention. It can cause some pain. So they'll tell you all of that. They may even give you some suggestions and some prescriptions on how to treat those things. But I am seeing the patients in palliative care that maybe their recommendations weren't enough, right? Maybe your symptoms, the nausea is just not relieved by what the doctor has ordered. So then they may suggest, I'd like you to see our palliative and supportive care team because they work alongside us. They know what our treatments are doing. They know what this cancer is doing. And so they are going to think outside the box and only focus on just those pain and symptoms. And you'll get 30 minutes with them, not just 15 minutes. And they'll go through everything. How are you sleeping? How are you eating? How are you breathing? How are your bowel movements? All of those types of things that are about just your day-to-day quality of life. So it really complements what you're receiving in your oncology care.
Got it.
So that's where I think, there's this nice blend. And so when they ask you to be seen by someone like me, that's what they're looking to provide you with, an extra layer of support.
Got it. So, folks, we're going to be taking a quick commercial break. You're listening to EBC Radio. This is 1170 AM. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. I'm talking to Tina Bassanese. She's an advanced nurse practitioner dealing with palliative care. And we'll be back right after this commercial break.
EBC Radio would like to thank St. Peter's Healthcare System, treating you better for life, for sponsoring the preceding program of Heartbeat Show. This part of the program is brought to you by St. Peter's Healthcare System, treating you better for life.
Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to EBC Radio. This is 1170 AM. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. You're listening to program Heartbeat. Today we have on the line with us Tina Bassanese. She is an advanced nurse practitioner who is the director of palliative medicine and supportive care at Astera Cancer Care. Our topic today has been a review of what palliative care is, what is hospice care, kind of understand the differences and the role this kind of care plays in the management of patients. So let's just make sure, Tina, you're still on the line?
Yes, okay, I am.
Perfect, great. So you said that even patients who have stage 2 cancer, so, you know, it could be, it's still a fairly early stage. There is still a role of palliative care. So I, again, want to kind of reinforce the fact that when a physician is referring to someone who specializes in this form, it by no means does it imply that the outcome of that treatment is going to be is not going to turn out to be as well as everybody is hoping for. It's just that there is an additional layer of support, which is there. So you already made that point, and I just kind of wanted to reinforce that. So can you just walk us through a little bit more of your typical visit with a patient? I know you kind of said, what is entailed, but a little bit more. And also, are you in a position to prescribe certain medicines, and maybe give us some examples of what you may have done recently in an office visit where it did make a difference for the patient?
Yes, absolutely. An initial visit often is an hour long. It involves usually, honestly, me explaining what palliative medicine is and how it works alongside and complements their oncology care. To be quite honest with you, physicians still struggle with, defining it themselves. So oftentimes it helps when once I get to meet someone in person, then I can really explain to them what the intention is of the visit. The doctors know what they're intending, but I think sometimes they're not always able to articulate it like I am, because this is what I do. But to be really honest with you, because you may be feeling this way too, a lot of times people will say to me, I almost didn't come today. Or I feel like my doctor isn't telling me something, that they're asking me to see you. What does this mean? I've had people say to me, you really should change the name of this program because it scares people off. So oftentimes the beginning of a visit is really me helping people develop trust that really their doctor is being forthright, that their doctor is actually recognizing that some of their physical pain and symptoms or the emotional stress of their illness is impacting them or their family members. And they know that that's sort of outside of their scope or their ability to give that much time to those aspects of the patient's needs. So after we get through kind of just making sure everybody's clear about what the visit's about, I'll often ask questions to try to understand who people are, just people before they were sick people. What did you do for a living? Tell me a little bit about your family. What are your hobbies? What do you enjoy? And that gives me a little bit of background about, who it is I'm about to take care of. And then we really talk about, you know, how are you experiencing your treatment? What do you find the most distressing to you? And then, you know, they'll start to tell me, well, you know, I still have a lot of back pain, I have rib pain, or I have numbness and tingling in my hands and feet, and it makes me feel unsteady when I walk. I feel very fatigued all the time. I'm just constantly tired. I want to sleep 20 hours a day. I have no interest in food. I just don't want to eat. I'm getting a lot of pressure from my family because I won't eat, but I just don't want to. So we kind of talk about the basic, like, day-to-day quality of life type, you know, behaviors and activities and feelings that, you know, sometimes, you know, is not the focus of a regular medical care visit. You know, and what I'll do is I keep my notes and I'll, you know, write this down, you know, okay, so fatigue is an issue for you. Appetite is an issue for you. This back pain and rib pain is an issue for you. And then we come up with a care plan of how are we going to manage those things? Sometimes it's just affirmation, you know, like, yes, unfortunately, fatigue is part of cancer. It emits enzymes that make you feel tired all the time. So you can't beat yourself up for feeling tired all the time. But the things that we may be able to do are get into a short walking routine every day where you feel like you're nourishing your body with some exercise. And when you exercise, you know, you are expending some energy, which then in turn makes more energy. And so some of these things are very practical, but people will feel grateful that someone is talking about it, maybe not just looking at pharmacology or medications to treat it, and kind of setting some goals together. You know, I'd like you to walk 3 days a week. And then when I talk to you again next week, I want to hear how is your walking, listening to the birds, getting some sun on your face, you know, and that then can help with some depression. So it's these small things that is improve the day-to-day quality of life. There may be sometimes that we will talk about, say, for fatigue, stimulant medication. So sometimes it is about medications, and I can prescribe those for them. I prescribe a lot of medication for pain. Some of them are as basic as, you know, encouraging the use of regular Tylenol or extra strength Tylenol, but taking it routinely instead of waiting till the pain gets very bad. Sometimes it's narcotic pain relievers. And a lot of times I'll have to talk to patients about, you know, their fears of addiction or dependence and reassure them that when we give it in small responsible doses and that it is actually relieving their pain, that that's the right use of that medication and that I will continue to be following them to look for signs of dependence or addiction if that's their fear. It's almost never an issue in palliative medicine when you're looking at patients that are living with, you know, a serious illness. The rationale for their cancer and the stimulus for the need for that medication is often right on track. And so working very closely together and talking about your pain, and sometimes it's not narcotic pain relievers. Sometimes I mentioned before that numbness or tingling in your hands and feet is a side effect of the chemotherapy. Very expected. So we can sometimes give medications to relieve that numbness and tingling, and those are non-narcotic medications. Some of those need very close monitoring. You have to be on certain levels for a certain period of time. Then they're increased. Then we continue to monitor. So everything that we do in palliative care is like the fine details of quality of life, where the oncologist focuses on the fine details of trying to kill the cancer. So we have different foci and intentionality in our visits. Our intentions are very different, and that's why they work so nicely together. And I tend to have more time. Palliative medicine visits tend to be, you know, like I said, 60 minutes or 30 minutes. It can involve multiple family members. listening to people's questions. There's so many myths and misunderstandings. So I can really dig in and do a lot of teaching and answering those questions. That's what, you know, I'm called to do. That's what I enjoy doing. And I have to tell you honestly, those patients that start out the visit a little angry, a little concerned, at the end of the visit, I've had patients tell me, this is the best medical visit I have ever had. This is the first time I've ever actually felt like an individual human being, because I feel like you listen to who I am, or you listen to, you know, what my spiritual needs are, or how this is impacting my family, or the burden I feel, or the fears I have about my future. And everything I focus on in my visits is about hope. It's all focused on what can we do to make a bad situation a little bit better. And that's the joy. That's what gives me joy. That brings me back to the original story of, you know, being in the intensive care unit and wanting to help make a bad situation a little bit better. Because even early stage cancer has side effects. Even early stage cancer, even when you know that you may be cured, there's still fear. And so if we can talk about those things, if I can refer you to also the right people, sometimes I refer to counseling, to social work. Sometimes there's financial concerns. I can refer you to the social worker to do Medicaid applications or community resources or, you know, foundations that can support financially. So again, it's this multi-centric, this real interdisciplinary focus of care. Who else on my care team can help relieve some of those concerns that someone has? So I think that a palliative medicine visit, you can anticipate somebody really listening, somebody digging into trying to get to know who you are and focusing on what medications can I give to relieve physical symptoms, insomnia, breathlessness, pain, constipation, all these practical things, depression. I can prescribe medications for all of those things. But can I also add another layer through listening, through counseling, through community resources, through going back to your doctor and letting them know what your wishes are? We do a lot of conversation about thinking about the future, having those hard thoughts and questions, completing those important forms that you get asked about every time you go to a doctor appointment, whether you're asked, oh, do you have a living will? Do you have an advance directive? Some people don't know what those documents are. And they get asked that question, and it can be very scary. Or they know what those documents are, and they're very scared to do that. They feel like even having a conversation about what my wishes would be would maybe bring on some negative consequence. And so I do a lot of those conversations by saying, let's just create a small space in our visit today to talk about what these forms are, how meaningful they are,
so let's
put them aside.
So let's talk about some of these forms and what they mean and what and when one should be putting them into place, whether it needs to wait for an illness, a certain age. So let's start with the advance directive. What does it mean? When should somebody be putting it in place? And does it have to wait for an illness or an age when that should be done?
An advance directive is a two-part form. It includes you naming someone that would be a medical decision maker for you, only medical decision making, and only in the event that you could not make a decision for yourself. So when you're creating part of this form, the top part of the form is establishing who would be that one person. We often encourage you to have alternate people in the event that that one person is not available. The other part of that form is an instruction directive. It gives instructions to the person that you're naming as your healthcare decision maker on specific things you would want in the event you couldn't make those decisions for yourself in that moment. This form is created to be used only in the event, one, that you cannot make decisions for yourself, and two, that you would meet a very specific criteria of serious illness, where you would either be in a terminal condition, where you would be permanently unconscious, and those things are outlined in that document, those specific scenarios where that document would be executed, where it would be utilized. If those circumstances don't exist, that form is just like any other insurance policy that sits in the filing cabinet and isn't used until the event happens. So the way I see an advance directive, it's like a car insurance policy for your health. It's like a homeowner's insurance policy for your health, right? You do this where you make these decisions about what you would want in the event of this specific event, and then you don't think about it again until you need it. So to Dr. Singhal's question, do you do it only when you're sick? In fact, it's to the contrary. You would want to do these forms when you're not sick, very early on. So blessedly at this moment in my life, I don't know that I have a serious illness, but I've done an advance directive 15 years ago. And the reason why I chose to do it then was because I was able to, without the fear the detail of associating with a specific illness, I was able to think about, in the event that I had this terminal illness or I had a serious illness, like I was permanently unconscious, what would my wishes be? How would I want life-saving equipment to be used? How would I want artificial food and water to be administered to me? And these are hard things to think about, especially when you're very sick. So it's easier oftentimes to complete this insurance policy, this healthcare insurance policy, when you're not sick. However, in the event that you have a serious illness, it's very appropriate to do that then. It's important to get that done. It's even more important to do that. And the main reason why that's important is because there will be someone you love that will be called to the task of making decisions for you. And you would want to help them, give them some guidance. And so sometimes when it's in black and white, it really does give someone something concrete to work off of. Again, I just want to make sure that it's very crystal clear that if you can speak for yourself, the document is not called into action. It's only in the event you couldn't speak for yourself. So even if you wrote something very specific in the document and you could speak for yourself, you could override that document. Do you know what I mean? It's not then executed. But I do want to make one clear point and one thing that I encourage with all of my patients. That is called an advance directive. That's that two-part form. But the thing that I think is more important and less frightening and easier to do is the one part of that form. And that you can do singularly as a standalone document. And that is the health care proxy. That is naming the medical decision maker. And that form is much less emotionally daunting. It doesn't include a lot of specifics that are actually put down on paper, but it encourages you to have a conversation with that one or two or three people that you will ask to make decisions for you in the event that you can't make the decision for yourself. And in that conversation, there'll be a fluidness about who you are as a person. What are your limits? How far would you want to be, kept artificially going. How do you feel about a feeding tube in the event that you have one of these serious conditions, like terminal illness, permanent unconsciousness? So what I'll often do is encourage people to have that conversation in a palliative care visit. The provider, the doctor, the nurse practitioner can, even a social worker, can encourage that conversation and support that conversation. In that, that person that is your medical decision maker, healthcare proxy, surrogate decision maker, all that language you might hear come from a doctor or a hospital, all of that is the same. It's one person that you trust with some alternate people that you trust that you've had a conversation with about what are your limits. And that's only the event of the most serious, serious catastrophic situation. Any other time, you'll make your decisions for yourself. You'll work through the information that you're given by your doctor and make your decisions at that time. So this is a very important document. It's very important to, as a responsible person, to just as you would make sure you had car insurance and you wouldn't drive a car, you know, without it. You would not want to be living with a serious illness and not make sure that you've done that important homework of completing that document or at least had those conversations with the people you love.
So to that point, does, again, just to reinforce this, does one need to have a serious illness to have this, or would you suggest, like you and I have done many years ago, that most adults have this document filed away, you know, because you never know what tomorrow might bring?
I absolutely do. I think it's so important to do it early. You know, it, I have to tell you, working with people with serious illnesses, it's much harder. You know, there are some people that are very comfortable. You know, they know what their limits are, but they maybe haven't expressed that to somebody. So that's why it's really important to have that done on paper or to have that conversation and have that healthcare proxy.
Right. So another form you had mentioned, just so we can clarify, was POST. Can you tell us a little bit about that? We have about a couple of minutes left. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know we only have a couple of moments left. So I just want to make one point to that, the advance directive or the healthcare proxy form, and to let you know that that does not need to be done by an attorney. That does, you don't need a lawyer for that. And in fact, it doesn't even need to be notarized. It just needs to be witnessed and have two witness signatures on the form that are not people that are listed as your decision makers. So I just want to make that clear. You don't have to hold off doing these forms until you have another appointment with your attorney or because, you know, or incur that expense of an attorney. It doesn't need that. It can just be signed by two witnesses that are basically signing that you, they're witnessing that you signed this document yourself. As far as a POST form, it stands for POLST, Practitioner's Orders for Life Sustaining Treatment. Now, how that form is different than an advanced directive or healthcare proxy form is, if that is actionable, provider's orders, meaning myself or Dr. Singhal have completed this form with you. In the event of a medical emergency, this form is your words and the doctor's orders, just like the doctor ordering you a pain medication or an antibiotic or a blood pressure medication. The doctor has ordered what your wishes are in the event that you can't speak for yourself. So in that form, it'll talk about, would you want cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which is CPR, which is someone to attempt to resuscitate your heart in the event that you became unconscious and your heart stopped? Would you want a feeding tube in the event that you, you know, did not have consciousness and you couldn't decide for yourself? This takes the ownership off of your healthcare representative to make those decisions. You've made your decisions between you and your doctor or you and your nurse practitioner, and that is what they would use in the event of an emergency. Your family members, of course, you know, will have that document, will know what your wishes are, and there is even an opportunity on that form for you to be specific and say that you would allow your healthcare proxy, your healthcare representative, to make changes to that form. However, most patients will say, I've made these decisions. I want my family members not.
WWTR Bridgewater.
EBC Radio would like to thank St. Peter's Healthcare System, Treating You Better for Life, for sponsoring the preceding program of Heartbeat Show.